Have been jailed for between 16 and 20 months for their part in looting in Birmingham earlier this month. One man was caught after being spotted on CCTV stealing a t-shirt from an Anno Armani store. Another handed himself into police after looting an Adidas shop. Harry Ireland from the Crown Prosecution Service says justice has caught up with these people.
Local businesses were ransacked and in some cases ruined. Today some of the opportunists who turned on their neighbours have learned that such behaviour is intolerable and carries with it inevitable serious consequences.
Meanwhile, the prison population in England and Wales has reached a record high for the third week running following the riots. But the government says there will be enough places for anyone jailed for taking part in looting or the rioting. Police in Nigeria say at least 18 people have been killed in a huge explosion at a United Nations building. A car loaded with explosives rammed into the building in the capital, Abuja. A woman whose husband and two children were killed in an arson attack on their home says she has no idea who would target them. Angela Sharkey has been speaking publicly for the first time since the incident in Helensburgh last month. She says she didn't remember a thing until her sister paid her visit.
I don't even know what the timing was, but it was my sister. She actually told me four times that Thomas, Bridget and Tommy were all dead. And each time I was like, don't be daft. You know, don't be stupid.
New research suggests 26 million people in Britain will be clinically obese by 2030. It's estimated the number of people with the condition will rise by 11 million over two decades, costing the NHS £2 billion a year. House prices rose in almost every part of England and Wales last month. The average price increased by 1.3%, according to the Land Registry. And Joey Barton has become a QPR player. The controversial midfielder has moved from Newcastle to the Premier League newcomers on a free transfer. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this bank holiday weekend is founder of the Avon Liberal Party all those years ago, and now Lib Dem MP for Bath, Don Foster. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, why was News International still paying Andy Coulson when he was David Cameron's press secretary in Tory central office? The phone hacking story exposing the culture of lies at News International Scotland Yard and potentially two in Downing Street relentlessly rumbles on. But we go back 25 years this week to 1986 and the Wapping dispute to hear just how much the British media has changed since that time. How the power of the owners and the editors has grown over the writers and the journalists since then. And as the 9/11's 10th anniversary approaches, we ask, is it possible to plant a bomb and blame it on your enemy? We hear that it certainly is from a man who did just that, but got caught. A neo-fascist in Italy jailed for life for the murder of three policemen. And health workers will be out on the streets of Kingswood and Clifton Down tomorrow afternoon canvassing your support. Why are they targeting Lib Dems and giving up their days off to stop the privatisation of the NHS? And Libya, is it all about freedom or are there ulterior motives such as petrodollars? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, wet. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, sunny on Saturday but showers on Sunday. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, a fairly sunny and dry week. Wow, amazing for a bank holiday. And next weekend, that's the 3rd and 4th of September, highs of 16 Celsius, sunny spells and showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests. Joining us this week, founder of Avon Liberal Party a long, long time ago, and the Lib Dem MP for Bath, that's Don Foster. Hi, Don, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Good to hear from you.
Now, first of all, you're on the Culture, Media and Sport Committee, is that right?
I'm not actually on the committee. I'm sort of like the Lib Dem sort of minister without the title. So I attend ministerial meetings and get involved with lots of stuff going on within that DCMS portfolio. So that's everything from the Olympics through to all the stuff we've been talking about recently on phone hacking.
Well, the first point then, let's go straight for the jugular here, because Lord Leveson has taken free business favours from Elizabeth Murdoch's husband, Matthew Freud's PR agency, and gone to parties at their house. I mean, why hasn't he declared his interest and stepped down from doing this inquiry into phone hacking?
I think, frankly, anybody that's in a senior position is likely to have had contact with all sorts of people in the media. I don't think there's anything he's done that's particularly wrong or different from many others. So,
but this isn't just contact, is it, Don?
Sorry?
This isn't just contact. This is actually accepting favours, business favours, for free from Matthew Freud's PR company.
The connections, I think, are very tenuous. I mean, I'm just desperately keen that we get on and get the inquiry carried out. I mean, let's face it, we've had a situation where we've had illegal activities by journalists. We've had illegal activities, it would appear, between journalists and the police. And, of course, there's all sorts of rather murky goings-on between politicians and journalists. And the sooner we get investigating it, the better, rather than spending all of our time worrying about who knew who and who's been to whose garden party. I think that's rather diverting from getting on with the job.
But say in a court case, for example, if a judge is going to garden parties at the place of the accused or prosecution, then he has to step down.
Well, you know, I don't know enough of the details of what the connections have been. I've just come back from 2 weeks on holiday. I've been keeping up in touch with all the news, obviously, and talking to people within the department. And certainly from what I've discovered, there's not enough that makes me think that this is a cause to delay getting on with the much-needed, much-delayed inquiry. I mean, when you think about it, in 2009, we had a report that told us that 350 journalists had been gathering personal data from people totally illegally, and no action was taken. Now we've had all of this stuff. I just want us to get on, get it investigated. I want to have those who've been responsible for wrongdoing brought to book, and I also want us to clean up the mess that we've currently got in our media and sort that out. And so, you know, I don't want to get involved with what I think are relatively minor issues to do with the contacts the guy leading the inquiry has got. I'm sure he'll do a perfectly sensible job.
Now, you, I know, are very interested in the welfare of the elderly specifically, but now we're seeing quite a lot of privatisation, particularly here in Bristol, of things like home care, and also, rather more worryingly, for millions of elderly people, the robbing of their pension pots. I mean, obviously, this isn't just for the elderly, but it's people who are in work now as well, who are looking towards having a decent pot of pension money for their retirement.
Well, I think there are two separate issues there, Tony. I mean, I think on the first, the issue of this so-called privatisation, I've always been a believer that it's not necessarily appropriate for government, whether it's national or local government, to be providing all the services on which we rely. It's the job of government to ensure that we have those services provided and we find the best people to provide them. If you go back to the early days of the Margaret Thatcher privatisation, it was done in such a ham-fisted way. I mean, you know, you saw situations where people took over our rubbish collection and then could hold us to ransom because they had the only rubbish-collecting trucks that were available. We've moved on a long way from that situation, and I think it's now important that we make sure we're providing the services that people need and we don't get quite so hung up on who is actually providing the service.
Do you think it's right to be making profits out of caring for elderly people? Is that okay in your book?
If it means that the quality of care that the people get is the highest possible level, and if it means that we can get it at a sensible price, then I don't have a concern about that, and I don't think anybody should. I think what matters is ensuring not only that we get high quality provision of service, that we get them at a reasonable price, but we also have a guarantee of continuity of that care. And as we've seen with some of the care homes recently that have closed down, clearly that we still haven't got it entirely right. But it doesn't mean to say that the state can provide everything. You know, we'd have state making our bread and making our food and those sorts of things, things we really do rely on, and that, frankly, would be crazy.
Now, is it? Do you think a coincidence that the awful scenes that we saw in the Panorama documentary about the Winterbourne care home, obviously it wasn't an elderly care home, but do you think it's coincidence that that was something that had been fairly recently privatised?
Well, I think that's a very good example of where if you're going to have other people providing services for us, whether it's the state or anybody else, private contractor or a not-for-profit organisation, you've also got to have proper systems of surveillance, people going in and checking what's going on. And I think that's frankly where the failure was. And I mean, it is appalling that we have to wait to rely upon a panorama investigative team getting that information and data that then horrifies all of us, when we're meant to have in place a proper inspection regime that clearly was failing.
Okay, thanks, Don. And now I'm also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers here in the studio. Martin, one of the economics bits of news this week is a bit of a shot across the bows from the Independent Commission on Banking, which is due to report in about 3 weeks' time. The banks are warning that there will be a tighter ICB rules, Independent Commission on Banking rules, will actually curb lending. So there'll be even the banks will be able to lend even less if the government tightens up on the rules on the banks.
I think that's right. I mean, there's the government have got a contradictory agenda here, and so have society in general, which is we want the banks to lend more, but we want them to have more solid reserves and all the rest of it. And in actual fact, as the banks quite rightly point out, these two things quite likely in contradiction.
So the Independent Commission on Banking, when it actually reports in 3 weeks' time, I've just been having a flick through the people who are on that so-called Independent Commission. We've got Sir John Vickers, Claire Spottiswood, Martin Taylor, who's a former chief executive of Barclays, Martin Wolfe, who's a writer at the Financial Times, also very friendly with bankers through this Bilderberg organisation, which he goes along to every year. And also we've got the co-CEO of JP Morgan Investment Bank, Bill Winters. Can I ask you, Don, what are your thoughts about just how independent this Independent Commission on Banking is? Because it looks like most of the people there are pretty much embedded in the revolving doors of the banking industry.
I think you're right to be concerned about that. I mean, some of the involvement of some of those people does lead you to question whether or not we, the public, who are deeply concerned, as Martin rightly says, we need to get the banks lending, whether they're going to give us the sort of results that we want to see as to how we're going to achieve it. But one of the things that I genuinely don't understand why the coalition government hasn't been able to press ahead with more quickly, and that is the fundamental separation within our banking system between what we could call straightforward high street banking, lending to you and me, mortgages, small businesses, that sort of thing, with the sort of casino banking, the high risk stuff that caused so much of the problems in the past. It seems to me that we ought to have a system whereby we as the government support the banks in terms of their basic lending to you and me, to small businesses and so on, but have absolutely no commitment to bail out banks that are involved in all of this sort of casino racket of borrowing money to big institutions, you know, selling stocks and shares, making money on the money markets, all of that sort of thing. You know, these should be separated out. And if they go and lose their money, well, they're the ones who should lose out and not us.
Martin, any ideas why it might be that it's been proving so difficult to separate, as Don says, these two sectors
of
banking?
Well, I mean, we're dealing with what Milton Friedman would characterise as vested interest within the state now. I mean, the banking system has become a ward of the state, and once, you know, like nationalised industries used to be, once you become a ward of the state, you're in a position to put pressure on to get what you want.
But just a minute, the government has bailed out the banks. How come they can put pressure on the government? Surely all the cards are in the hands of the government.
Well, the problem is it's a stable door horse bolted problem, which is that the banking system has collapsed and we're not dealing with an ideal situation.
So it hasn't actually collapsed yet.
It has actually collapsed, but it's been propped up by government expenditure, which of course is a hole below the bows for the whole free market philosophy. I'd just like to pick up on the separation issue that Don mentioned there. I thoroughly agree with that. I mean, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed in the 1990s in the United States under a Democratic administration, and that Glass-Steagall Act was put in place in the 30s by by the reforming Roosevelt administration for a very good reason, because it was to avoid exactly the situation that we found ourselves in. So I don't know why anybody's surprised that we've ended up in this mess. They lobbied to have be allowed to have the support of the state for investment banking. They got it, and then they did exactly what could be predicted, which is they used that support and abused it. But of course, we're not actually talking about an ideal situation now. Ideally, we wouldn't have done that, and we wouldn't be in the situation. So you then have problems as a government. The coalition has a problem, and even if it was a different government, we'd still have a problem of, are we really prepared to let them collapse? And I think there is a strong argument for saying yes, actually, but there are a lot of consequences follow from that.
Dawn, I wonder if you had the ear, which I imagine you do occasionally, of George Osborne. What should he be doing right now? Because we also hear this week that the charges against Dominic Strauss-Kahn are going to be dropped. So it looks as if his plans to consolidate debt amongst all the Western countries and really put the change the balance of power between the IMF, stopping them being able to divide and rule between Portugal, Spain, Italy, Ireland, and all these different countries. That's changed things as well, because Dominic Strauss-Kahn isn't being able to bring this in now, and he's kind of been sidelined. But ultimately, you know, what would you do?
I'd start domestically, and I mean, I just go back to what Martin was saying a second ago. I mean, I accept it is difficult for any government to do the sort of separation that both he and I suspect the vast majority of listeners want to see, but I still don't understand, from what Martin was saying, perhaps he could just explain it so I understand, what is it that prevents government from actually requiring that straightforward separation from casino bank and high street lending? I can't see what the barrier is. And I think if we can get our own house in order and use that as an example, and as Martin rightly says, it used to apply in the States, it can be done, it has been done. If we can start to get our own house in order, we'll lead by example.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I thoroughly support that policy. But I think part of the problem is, A, we've got the political power of the investment bankers is enormous. They pay for a lot of politics in the United States, for example. There's no doubt about it, whether both Democrats and Republicans.
But they don't pay here, surely?
They do indirectly. I mean, you will find that a lot of money going to Tory party coffers will be coming from hedge fund type people. There's no doubt about that. The other problem, of course, is that we're now in a situation, when we were talking earlier about tightening ICB talking about tightening the rules up about the credit, you know, the resources that banks need to have to trade. There is a tension between that and getting them lending. So if you were to separate out the two, there was a danger that you would then potentially cause a run on the banks. Now, I'm not saying it's something that should deter us completely, but you can see the problem that you've got. It's basically like having somebody in the room who's wearing a suicide belt and threatening to blow themselves and you up unless you do as they say. And in a way, you have to talk nicely to those people, because the danger is that the banking system will collapse. But I'm afraid we're staring a banking collapse in the face anyway. And much of the political class are in denial about this. It's not just a river in Egypt, as I fondly say. The fact is the banks are insolvent, not illiquid, and most of the policies that have been pursued are on the assumptions that the banks are basically sound, they just need to be cleaned up a bit. In fact, they need to be wound up, and we need a much more radical policy. And any government could follow that policy. A conservative liberal coalition with a radical perspective could follow that policy. It's not necessarily a Labour policy. It isn't a Labour policy. But once the banks are really in trouble, as I think they will be very shortly, we'll have to start asking even more fundamental questions like, do we need a private banking sector at all?
Okay, moving on to the next story here. And retailers, well, it's still a financial one. Retailers are gloomy as fall in sales accelerates. And this is the CBI saying this in the Telegraph on Thursday. The CBI Distributive Trade Survey reported that 46% of retailers saw a fall in sales the 2 weeks to August the 16th, with 31% seeing a rise. The resulting sales balance fell to minus 14 in August from minus 5 in July. Oh, more gloomy news, Don. It doesn't seem like the current Libcon Alliance's policies on the economy are working, because people aren't spending money in the high streets and shops are having to shut as a result.
But look, can I just say, Tony, because I'm miles away over here in Bath, I'm having quite a lot of difficulty hearing the conversation. If there's a way you can turn it up, that would be helpful. But I think we have to remember where we started. We're currently spending £120 million per day just to service the national debt. That's not to pay any of the debt off, just to actually service it. We've got to take the very tough action, the very difficult action that is currently being taken to try and get ourselves back on track. And anybody who thought that was going to be easy and we'd see a massive hike in the economy overnight was frankly crazy. It is going to be difficult. It is proving to be difficult. But actually, there's a lot of really good things going on. We're seeing an increased number of jobs in the private sector. That's very welcome. We've seen some increase even in engineering, something we haven't, in manufacturing, something we haven't seen for very many years under previous government. We've got far more people going into things like apprenticeships, which is very much to be welcomed. So I think there's a lot of, reasonably good news, although I don't for a minute deny that it's pretty difficult out there. We're all suffering from it. Anybody listening at the moment knows that life for them is very much more difficult than it was, but that's because we're frankly living beyond our means.
One thing possibly that Mr. Cameron could have done would be to revisit the decision to take away the contracts to build trains from Bombardier in Derby. We hear this week that Bombardier's hopes the government will halt a £1.4 billion train contract, which was awarded to a German rival, Siemens, have been dashed. David Cameron wrote to Chris Williamson, Labour MP for Derby North, saying he would neither reverse the decision or revisit it, nor would he meet a delegation to discuss the issue. Martin, maybe you first on this one. Do you think this is it's a decision, surely, which could have been looked at again, because we're talking about £1.4 billion, which is could have been being spent here in Britain, and now is going to be being spent abroad building trains?
That's not quite true, because I believe the people who've won the contract also have business in Britain, and the Bombardier aren't a British-owned company, even though they're based in Derby. I think we need an industrial policy. We've needed an industrial policy for years, but it's a dirty word or dirty phrase.
Is that true, Don? Is it having an industrial...
In Germany and France, they would never have allowed something like this to happen.
Is having an industrial policy a dirty word over here?
I'm not sure I'd use the same language that Martin does, but I have to say on this particular issue, I think some of the information that we've been being provided with by officials at the Department for Transport is somewhat disingenuous. I mean, if you look at the claim that Siemens would create up to 2,000 new jobs, including, I think it's 600 maintenance jobs, they don't make the point that those would have been created if Bombardier had won the contract. But Martin's right in one sense. If we can find ways within the European Union rules, and for heaven's sake, why is it that we always seem to be meticulous about abiding by the rules and other countries don't seem to in the same way, then maybe we could have found a way of getting this contract. But it is difficult, but I don't see any reason at all why the Prime Minister says he can't look at it again. Surely at least we can look at it to make sure that, yes, we've got to abide by the rules. If we don't abide by international trading rules, then, it's just a free-for-all and we'd lose out. But if we can do it within the rules, we ought to be looking at ways of doing it. And I confess on this particular issue, I think the Prime Minister should be looking again.
Well, I agree with that, and I think, in France and Germany, they do work within the rules, but they're much more creative about how they approach the rules. We've got a free market philosophy here, and that was true under New Labour as well, where anything goes, and we even make a virtue of the fact that we allow our industries to be bought up by outside forces. But of course, ultimately, you end up with the research and development and the planning and the strategy not being in-house in Britain, and ultimately you lose out massively in the long run. And Britain's lost out massively over the last 30 years because the philosophy of having an industrial policy has just not been there. If you go to places like Finland or Norway, for example, my favourite country, they've never given up on having industrial policies. We did.
Now, health workers from across the city, that is Bristol, will be out on the streets tomorrow in Kingswood and Clifton Down. Karen Cole from Public Sector Trade Union Unite explains why.
We see no reason for this reorganisation at all. Andrew Lansley was planning this for 5 years, and this reorganisation was announced weeks after the Condem government came into power. It wasn't in their manifesto. In fact, David Cameron said there'd be no top-down reorganisation of the NHS. They lied.
Well, that's that was Karen Cole from Public Sector Trade Union Unite, who, amongst others, will be out on the streets tomorrow afternoon in Kingswood and Clifton Down, signing up to a petition and also informing the public of what's going on to the National Health Service. Don, on this one, the Lib Dems could play a crucial role here, couldn't they? And it does seem that these changes are going ahead despite the fact that many of the Liberal Democrat members of your party actually don't support them at all.
Well, I mean, let's be absolutely clear. It was because of the Liberal Democrats that we got the so-called pause, the opportunity to consult more widely. It was because of the Liberal Democrats that a number of changes have now been proposed. And I think it's wrong for anybody to be arguing that we know what the final outcome is when the bill is still going through Parliament and there's a lot of water to flow under very many bridges before final decisions have been made. But, you know, you've only got to look at some of the decisions that were made in the beginning. For instance, these GPs making all the decisions, many of us argued that was crazy to not involve other clinicians, people, for instance, who worked in our hospitals. Those are the sort of changes that we're now going to see. We're also going to see a very clear commitment to avoid privatisation, although I don't actually think that was the original intention, but it's going to be made very clear that that can't take place. And we're also going to see a very clear responsibility on the Secretary of State, which is something people were demanding quite rightly, to ensure the provision of high quality health services in this country and make it a direct responsibility of government to be doing that, which of course is pretty obvious to me, but some people are concerned it wasn't going to happen, and now because of the Liberal Democrats it is going to happen.
Now, I'm getting a bit of creepy deja vu over this one, because I can remember when they first started talking about privatising the Royal Mail, they said, oh, well, the private companies can come in and then they actually bid for certain services. It just so happened they bid for the services which were the most profitable services, and they left the public sector, the old Royal Mail, to actually do all the dirty work, the stuff which wasn't profitable, which has meant that we're now in the position where it looks like there will be, possibly anyway, a full privatisation of the mail. Don't you think that actually may happen with the National Health Service too in this case, because it's a very similar kind of system they're bringing in, allowing these private companies to bid for whichever parts of the service provision that they want?
No, Tony, this is where I think you're making, and I suspect many other people are currently making, a big mistake. What we saw under the Labour government was a situation where they actually said that a certain amount of the health service was going to have to be provided by the private sector. They actually specified the amount. We saw setting up in our region a number of these intermediate treatment centres that were able to cherry pick some of the easy operations, hip operations, whatever it might be, causing a real problem for the main providers. If you take, you know, a major hospital, suddenly its unit costs go up because all that relatively simple operations were taken away from it, and yet if anything goes wrong with those simple operations done in the private sector, suddenly the problem is lumped back on the major hospital. What we've now said, and I think we should have said it from the beginning, but we are now saying it, is there won't be the ability to cherry pick in the way you're describing.
One of the things with this whole business, Dawn, is that I mean, the Lib Dems are now in a position where you do to a large extent hold the balance of power. You know, it's almost like you have the possibility to squeeze stuff from the Tory government, because they are relying on you. Are you happy you've squeezed that enough from the health service provisions that Andrew Lansley's trying to push through?
Let's be absolutely clear. This is not the Liberal Democrats in opposition to the Tories. We're in coalition with them, and people have to understand that while many of us would have preferred, of course, a Liberal Democrat government, you know, at the end of the election, the outcome was no one party had overall control. Liberal Democrats talked to Labour, they walked away from it. For the need to have a secure government to give us the financial stability we needed, we came together. So, of course, both sides are having to make compromises. And Liberal Democrats are going to try and get as much as we possibly can, of course, but we have to accept we can't get everything that we want. But in terms of things that we've wanted to achieve, for instance, something you'd never have seen under a Tory government, a pure Tory government, the raising of the tax threshold, taking nearly a million people out of paying tax altogether, really supporting the least well-off in society. That's the sort of thing we've seen, the pupil premium, putting in £3.5 billion into our schools to help children from least well-off backgrounds. That's, again, the Liberal Democrats having real influence. But we're not going to have everything we wanted because we haven't got a Liberal Democrat government, unfortunately.
Martin, one of the first things that Karen said there was, and we'll be hearing a longer interview with her after the 6 o'clock news, that there was actually no reason to have any kind of a reform. Is that something you'd agree with?
Well, I think that's right. There's one Conservative MP whose name, I'm afraid, escapes me, who said, I'm not convinced that the Prime Minister and Andrew Lansley have convinced me that what the problem is in the health service that these reforms are supposed to address. And they seem to be forgetting the old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And don't forget, the electorate were promised by David Cameron no top-down reform of the health service. Now, he's finessed that by saying, no, this isn't a top-down reform, this is a big society reform coming from the bottom, which is basically disingenuous in my view. But leaving that aside, the politics of it are quite clear. The health service could have been a matter of cross-party consensus and just taken out of the political battle. The Conservatives have put it right back at the heart of the battle. I'm glad that the Liberals are getting concessions, but we're actually marching in the wrong direction. There is a case for planning. There is a case for the state providing a lot of things. There really is, and it hasn't probably been made for a generation. The NHS, for example, is a big buyer of drugs. They are a monopoly or monopsony buyer of drugs. They could force down the price of drugs. We could nationalise the drugs industry and get really cheap. Many countries are talking about doing exactly that. Now, I'm a socialist because I believe in a degree of economic planning. Don is a liberal because he believes in less planning than I do, even though we've got the same social goals. But I think ultimately the idea that the market solves all problems is like, you know, because you've got a hammer in your hand, every problem looks like a nail.
Isn't that one of the problems here, that we're starting to introduce the market into the NHS, Don, which is not really an appropriate place? It's kind of like the law of the jungle, isn't it, the market?
Listen, you're trying to put Martin and me fighting against each other when actually, broadly speaking, we seem to be agreeing. I believe that the role of government is to provide where the market cannot. And there are many examples within the health service where I genuinely don't believe that the market can provide. Martin's 100% right that we can use the muscle that government has over its purchase of drugs, over its purchase of computer systems, over its purchase of an inordinate number of things, to be able to drive down price, to improve the level of quality, to ensure that we're getting real value for money for the taxpayers. And we don't do enough of that. The coalition government is looking at ways we can improve our purchasing power and getting real value for money out of it, but there is a long way still to go on that. Martin and I don't disagree, but where the private sector cannot provide, and that doesn't just mean whether it can do it here and there once in a blue moon, but provide securely over a period of time, then if they can't do that, that's the role of government to intervene and to provide it.
Well, on to the big story of the week now, and that's clearly Libya. The BBC were in the embarrassing position this week of having to do several U-turns in their coverage of the Libyan civil war. This is from one of Tuesday morning's news bulletins on BBC Radio 5 Live.
One of Colonel Gaddafi's sons, Saif al-Islam, has appeared in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, despite claims by the rebels yesterday that they'd captured him. He said government forces had broken the rebels' backbone after luring them into a trap. He also insisted that his father was safe in Tripoli. Yesterday, the International Criminal Court backed the rebels' claim that he'd been arrested.
So, yeah, even the International Criminal Court being tricked there into thinking that Saif had been arrested. Don, what are your thoughts about what's been happening this week? Are you pleased to see an end to the conflict? And do you think that it's going to be good for the people of Libya?
Well, I wish you were right in saying that we've seen an end to the conflict. I mean, I was listening to the news just before we came on air and hearing some appalling stories of people just being murdered. I mean, civilians who are being murdered, some with their hands tied behind their back and so on. I mean, the violence, sadly, is still continuing. I'm delighted to hear that negotiations are going on between the interim government and some of the tribal leaders
in Gaddafi's remaining stronghold of his former birthplace in Sirte. But I hope that they're successful, because sadly bloodshed is continuing. But it certainly is the case that at last we appear to have seen the end of a dictator who's brought a lot of trouble to his people, and I'm very pleased that we were able to provide support to the rebels so that they were able to bring this about.
Now, before all this happened, before March, Libya was actually one of the best countries in Africa to live in. I mean, the things like the infant mortality rate was incredibly low, the basic standards like education and healthcare very, very good compared to all the other countries in Africa. And now the place is in a terrible mess, particularly after the bombing of the infrastructure by British and NATO planes.
And I'm not sure, Tony, therefore, what your point is. I mean, if you saw real inhumanity going on, you saw, that the sort of murders and killings that were going on by the regime and so on, should we have just stood by and said, oh, good, you've got low levels of infant mortality, you've got reasonably high education levels, therefore we'll let you carry on? I think not.
What about the resolution 1973 at the United Nations? Actually, said nothing about bombing from the air, and certainly not about supporting with arms the troops and sending our special forces in. That was just simply a no-fly zone, and NATO has gone way beyond that, Don.
Well, there are legal battles to be fought over those definitions. I entirely accept, but frankly, I think the right decisions were taken in support of the rebels. I think we can be very pleased at the contribution that we have played. I think there's a lot that still has to be done. We know a lot is going on behind the scenes, helping the interim government to get up and running, because one of the things that we've got to see very quickly, and a lesson we have to learn from what went wrong, in my view, in, for instance, Afghanistan, is to make sure that we have got a functioning government with all the civil service structures in place, and above all, we need to have security on the streets, which means that we need rapidly to get rid of some of the far too many guns that are on the streets. We need to get police back on the streets and so on. And I know that behind the scenes we're doing our best to help make that happen.
Well, before we hear from Martin on this, for residents of Tripoli, there's a feeling of euphoria amongst some as Gaddafi's feared mercenaries are no longer roaming the streets. Here's Fatima speaking from Tripoli earlier this week.
See these truckloads of mercenaries inside our neighborhoods, inside our streets. You hear about families who they go inside their house and they do things to their women and all these bad stories. This is building and building and building and building of fear, you know. He closed off the city, he closed off the internet, so all we have is just the TV when we have the electricity. And then you hear like these people outside in cars shouting and going into people's houses. This is how he was able to make everybody afraid to go out and just waiting for, you know, our freedom fighters to come and into the city and unlock it, you know, to make it free.
Well, the city of Tripoli now free, apparently, Martin. And what are your thoughts about what's been going on this week? Because we heard, really, I think it was Sunday night, or Sunday was the first day, that actually there was a kind of operation going on within Libya. And actually what happened is that the rebels had got lots of little cells inside Tripoli, and suddenly, at a queue, they all rose up. And so that's why we got the situation we have now.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't like to try and second guess what's going on in Tripoli at the moment, sitting here in a studio in Bristol. It seems facetious. I would point out, though, that the rebels have some pretty unsavoury characters in their ranks, and there is evidence that they've carried out atrocities both in Benghazi and in Tripoli. We shouldn't be rosy-eyed about this. Remember what happened in Iraq, not so much Afghanistan, where there was no functioning government in many rural parts of Afghanistan ever. In Iraq, you did have a functioning state which fell apart, and then immediately you found that the victors in the war against Saddam Hussein started to take revenge against the losers, and the interior ministry in Iraq was involved in all sorts of disappearances, killings and so on, even though they were being armed and trained by Western advisors. Don't forget the Islamic fighting group in Libya are Libya, Al-Qaeda Libya. They are part of the coalition which has just come to power.
One of the things we keep hearing from the TVs is this Allah Al-Akbar.
Well, there's nothing wrong with people being Muslims, but I mean, the point is we shouldn't be starry-eyed about who these folks are, we could easily end up with a situation where continued fighting goes on, where certain tribes and certain individuals will not accept the new regime and they'll carry on fighting. And that's what happened in Iraq, that's what happened in Afghanistan. We can expect it in Libya, frankly.
Okay, on to the next story. A man has died after a taser arrest near Bolton. Well, it's not just one man. The IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission, is to investigate the use of a taser to subdue a 53-year-old man, which was the third fatal arrest using a stun gun or pepper spray in just a week. A man who stabbed himself in the abdomen, allegedly, has died after being tasered by police officers. Philip Humes, 53, was hit with an electric probe from the stun gun after barricading himself in his home in Overholton near Bolton. It's thought a concerned relative called the police. But this is actually the third within a week of people who've died whilst being arrested by the police. Now, Don, this is sounds a little bit strange, doesn't it? Two taser deaths in a week. Are these things safe to use for the police?
Frankly, I don't know, and I don't think I'm in a position to make that judgment. What I do know is in one case, at least, we now know from the inquiries that have taken place that the reason why he died is because he'd actually stabbed himself and not because of the taser. But, you know, one of the things that that's why we have an independent press police complaints commission is to look at each and every one of these cases very thoroughly, and they're the ones who, frankly, when they've done the inquiry, will be best placed to advise us as to whether tasers are safe. I mean, I find them somewhat unsavoury, but on the other hand, you know, if they can be used safely, bring violence to an end, and so on, and to protect us in the streets without causing death or injury to people, then clearly there is some merit. But, you know, let's wait and see what the inquiries bring.
Well, obviously, I would second that. It's very easy for people who are pontificating on a radio show to decide what happened in an individual incident which we've no knowledge of. I think one of the issues around this, though, the Police Complaints Authority, or the Independent Police Complaints Authority, is, of course, the shooting of Mark Duggan at the beginning of the rioting the other week, and the deaths in custody of many ethnic minority young people at the hands of the police over the last few years, none of which have led to prosecutions of any police officers. And I think, you know, one has to presume that we're talking about hundreds of cases here, that at least one or two of those cases, there must have been a case to pursue, surely. And of course, the faith of young people and certain communities in the police is eroded unless some police officers are held to account. Look at the Ian Tomlinson case and so on. You know, there's a question about how much teeth the independent Police Complaints Authority has got.
It's also a bit worrying that with several other deaths recently, the Sean Hoare, the journalist who was working for the News of the World, he was a key witness against Andy Coulson, and also Christopher Shale, who was David Cameron's constituency party chairman. And none of these inquests have actually been able to... Sorry, they haven't had proper inquests yet, but post-mortems in all those three cases were just unable to establish a cause of death. Isn't this just a way of saying, well, you know, actually, it can't have been the taser?
Yeah, well, if you're asking me, well, I think that you're mixing two things up there, Tony. I mean, we're talking about the police killing people, and then you're talking about you know, other suspicious murders or deaths, as it were. I think the issue of the police is a live one. People don't believe that the police actually are held to account. Now, that may just be a perception. Maybe in all the hundreds of cases where ethnic minority young people have died in the last few years, the police acted correctly. But I find it hard to believe they acted correctly in every case and that nobody's ever been held to account.
Don Foster, you're a Lib Dem MP for Bath. Can you just tell us what your thoughts are about this Independent Police Complaints Commission and how confident you are that they really are able to, as many of them, of course, are ex-police themselves, actually properly investigate the police impartially?
Well, I mean, based on the examples I picked up, and, you know, I'm no expert on this, but, you know, the ones we read about in the newspapers, to suggest that there haven't been any examples where police have been found guilty of incorrect behaviour is clearly wrong. I mean, there have been numerous cases where that is the case. Whether in every single case they get it right, I frankly don't know. I'm not in a position to make that judgment. But I've not had any evidence brought to me that suggests that there is a wholesale problem with the operation of the IPPC.
Okay, now, Marina Morris has been out on the streets to find out what you make of the phone hacking scandal so far, especially for you, Don.
Channels are owned by Mr. Murdoch, and have you stopped by them? There's a lot of them. News International, say The Times, The Sun, now defunct News of the World, not sure about the rest of the papers. Then he's got paper interests throughout Australia, America, so The Washington Post, New York Times, I believe, a few others. And then radio, well, he owns the Fox Network. Then obviously he owns Sky in this country and probably numerous other ones throughout other countries, I'd imagine. I probably would have stopped buying them.
The Times and The Sun and some local papers probably, and also, you know, it's a TV thing. I haven't bought a newspaper in 5 years, but probably would have stopped buying them as a result of that if I had.
Well, I know it was the News of the World, which they've shut that down. They did The Times, and then there was the problem about B Sky B. That's on The Sun, I think. I know News of the World was the main problem with the hacking, and that's the one they had to put to rest, really. My husband just buys The Times once a week. He buys it because he likes the sport and the finance and the photography, so he doesn't really think about who actually owns it. He buys it for his own interest, really.
I never bought them in the first place. I always thought they were a bit sensationalistic and a bit trashy. And Fox News in America is very right-wing and just, I find, really sensationalistic and not very news-based, but more opinion-based.
What should be done about phone hacking?
I think the laws need to be tightened up on it to make it much harder. I think public awareness needs to be improved so that people know how they were doing these things, so they can stop being a victim themselves, potentially.
Mobile phone companies should join with the police and the law enforcement people to do what they can to stop it and report people who get caught doing it.
It should be made legal, what it is.
Well, I guess the law on it has to be made clearer. Just people being made held responsible, and if that comes from the top, as in Rupert Murdoch, I mean, he does seem to be a bit slippery. It just needs to be clearly defined and then stamped out, really, from the top down.
Well, I think we need to look at all forms of new technology. It's all around us. I mean, if you look at what they're doing with music rights and reproducing things for your iPod, I think the world is changing, and the laws that protect us need to change as well. And certainly when you're having a telephone conversation that's meant to be private between two people, that the rights and the privacy for that should be protected, and people should be accountable by law when they hack your phone.
Does it reflect badly on David Cameron?
I think it does. I think it reflects very badly on his judgment, particularly with Andy Coulson and his close relationship with basically Rupert Murdoch, the lady who was the editor at the time that he seems to be very friendly with. I was reading in the papers today that he used to sign off his mail Love David to her. So it does make you wonder about the relationship between the media and the politicians and just how closely in bed they are.
No, he's not been doing any phone hanging.
Not especially. He just happens to be the Prime Minister at the time, but I dare say this has been going on for a long time. Maybe he should be more careful with who he employs, perhaps. But most people have skeletons in their cupboards. When you're in that sort of position, somebody will find some dirt on you anyway, so perhaps this is just his piece of dirt.
It all started far before he became the Prime Minister anyway, and I suppose he has tried to get to the bottom of it, you know, starting this independent inquiry. And I know he was friendly with that lady, I've forgotten her name. I think he's trying to do as much as he can, really.
I think if you look at certainly what's happening with the Met Police, it reflects pretty badly on them. I think his response to it is a bit lazy. You know, that could potentially reflect badly upon him. But, I mean, if you look at who's being implicated now, you know, certainly the police and some of the people that David Cameron appointed, it certainly reflects badly on. I mean, I'm no fan of David Cameron, but there's no finger directly pointing to him.
Why has this story taken 6 years so far to come out?
It's taken 6 years to come out because of the amount of vested interest for various groups that there's been. It would appear that the police were in the pockets of Rupert Murdoch's News International. So you can see that there's a conflict of interest there in them thoroughly investigating it. It's obviously in political interest not for this to come out, because you don't know what sort of deals are cut for political support within the newspapers, that kind of thing. Obviously there was the big issue of Rupert Murdoch's group trying to buy out the rest of B Sky B to give them 100% ownership in that. That should have really gone to a public inquiry, but it didn't. I think there's a large political influence there as well, and I expect there's probably a lot more to come.
Because there's a lot of money involved and rich people involved, and they can use their money to stop the story from hitting the surface, but eventually it does, and it has.
I suspect Murdoch has a very good way of ensuring things don't come out so easily. He's a very wealthy guy.
I suppose because it was so cleverly disguised as to who was doing what and who was responsible. Only one of the journalists has been imprisoned, and I just think it's very hard to prove. They watched their backs, and that the people were unaware, all the celebrities, sports stars, politicians, they were all unaware that it was going on. It was just so deep underground. But I think, you know, now that they've got one in prison, then the story is unravelling.
They probably had a hard time finding hard evidence. I mean, I remember reading a blog that Hugh Grant had done when he got a reporter for the News of the World to admit to phone hacking and the way they track celebrities, and people thought that it was just limited to celebrities who put themselves out in the public eye, and some were shocked by that, and some thought, well, you asked for it. But certainly when you look at what they were doing with private conversations around Minnie Dowler and members of the royal family, I think that's when people really understood that there was a disgrace here, and then asked for action on it.
Now, Lib Dem MP for Bath, Don Foster, one of the people that Marina interviewed there out on the street, was saying that this whole thing took such a long time to come out because it was very cleverly disguised. Do you think there's still going to be more revelations? I mean, it certainly seems there may be.
I think there's no doubt there's going to be a great deal more come out. I think many people will remember Rebecca Brooks when she left the News of the World. She said there's more to come. And I mean, she's one person who knows more than many about what's been going on. And she says there's more to come. It's the one occasion when I'm prepared to believe her. And I'm really worried. We now know that there are somewhere in the region of 3,000 people whose phones have been hacked that the police know about. Not all of them have yet been told who they are, and we certainly haven't been told, and I think we're going to find much more about that. But we're also going to find out more about some of the other illegal ways in which journalists have been obtaining information. We're going to find out more about the links between journalists and police, and I'm sure we're going to find out more about links between politicians and journalists. So there's a lot more still to come.
It does seem that a lot of this is, if you just take the police aside for a moment, it's a bit of a battle, really, between the power of the politicians and the power of Rupert Murdoch. Now, who's actually the most powerful? Who's in charge, Don?
Well, I think what we've seen with all these revelations and the action that has been taken, that whether it's belatedly, and it is belatedly or not, the politicians are now beginning to do something about it. But as I've said before, in 2009, there was very clear evidence. The Information Commissioner provided a report saying 350 cases of illegally obtaining information, private information, took place, and yet there was no investigation whatsoever on that occasion. And this, therefore, comes down to the public. They're the ones who've made this happen. As one of the people in your clip said, people were perhaps not that concerned when it was about politicians or film stars, famous people. But when it was Millie Dowler, when it was the victims of 7/7 and so on, then the public were outraged and demanded action, and politicians had to act, and thank goodness we at long last have.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we shouldn't make this a party political affair because, you know, basically the influence of Murdoch over all the political parties and the political process is the issue, both here and in the United States. And I was reading some extracts from Chris Mullen's diary, who is a left Labour MP, and he, in his diary he was saying that some years ago he was taken aside by John Major and they sank a bottle of wine together and discussed how they could stitch up Rupert Murdoch, because even at that stage politicians were aware from different political parties and different political perspectives of the outsized power that he wielded. And he's just one example of this modern media mogul power. We had Berezovsky in Russia. We've got Berlusconi in Italy. There was a guy called Maldonado who used to be a big shot in Brazil and still is. These kind of people are the modern overmighty subjects, and they need to be put back in the box.
Martin, I'm going to put the same question to you as I put to Don. If you put the police aside for a moment, who have, to a large extent have sort of held the balance of power between the two, who is going to win? Who is the most powerful, the media barons like Murdoch or the politicians?
The politicians have to assert that they are elected by the people and they will ultimately decide. And I think that was the turning point. I mean, it was a bit of a pantomime watching Rupert and his son at the select committee. But on the other hand, I think we needed to see it. Politicians have to show that they are elected by the electorate and that they are they're not beholden to vested interests, whether it's Rupert Murdoch, the investment bankers, or the military industrial complex. And people are still, actually the jury's out on that. People are still very aware. Politics, as Don will know, needs money. And when you need money, you have to go and ask for money. And the people with money then have demands that they make. And people are beginning to work that out, that who they vote for is only part of it. The people they elect need resources, and the people with resources exert undue influence.
So is it true, Don, that papers with massive circulation, never mind if they're comics like The Sun, can actually make or break a government?
I think it's over-exaggerated, but it clearly is something that worries many politicians. I mean, I said on air before, I remember vividly a debate in the House that I was taking part in about 2.5 years ago when we were discussing the issue of gambling. And a very honest Tory MP got up and said, look, we're not going to do anything about this because the Daily Mail would be on our case because they're against it. And I mean, you know, on so many occasions, we know that politicians have chosen their words to make sure they don't offend a particular newspaper or radio or TV program. So, of course, the media are influential. But, you know, one of the big questions we have to ask is, how did we have a regulatory system, the Press Complaints Commission, that operated in such a way that when Richard Desmond bought the Express newspapers, he simply said, I'm not going to have anything to do with it, and he walked away from it. And nobody could do anything about it. I mean, absolutely crazy. We had a regulatory system that was so, you know, voluntary that newspapers just said, well, I don't want to have anything to do with it, and they left. That's crazy, and that's got to be changed.
Now, with senior Scotland Yard officers implicated in the phone hacking scandal and the same squad that failed to investigate the crimes of the News of the World still in charge of UK anti-terrorist work, it's disappointing to hear that yet another Scotland Yard team are being accused of negligence by a woman that contacted the Operation Sapphire rape team at Scotland Yard to report a serious assault by the now convicted taxi driver Mark Warboys. The woman, who spoke to The Guardian anonymously, says the police just laughed at her evidence. And as a result, Warboys went on to seriously sexually assault 7 more women before he was finally arrested. And here is that special report from the Guardian website, a video report actually from the Guardian website, an extract from it now.
To start off, I must have reported the incident maybe 4, 5pm. And it had taken them well over 5 to 6 hours for someone to actually come to me. And upon reporting what had happened to me, I just felt like they weren't taking me seriously at all. When I told them about my injuries, they just laughed and said I must have just fallen over. And they kept questioning me on the fact that it was like they didn't believe that it was a licensed black Hackney carriage that I'd gotten into. They were convinced within themselves that it was an unlicensed illegal minicab. And that was in spite of the evidence of the CCTV footage.
Who were the officers who were laughing?
The uniformed officers. If the officers who looked at the case had taken my allegations seriously, such as if they looked at Warboy's car or vehicle, if they'd actually gone to his property, they would have found substantial pieces of evidence. They didn't do that. And as a result, so many more women went on to get harmed. I just don't think it's enough that they get a written warning or a verbal warning. I think so many lives were ruined because this case wasn't taken seriously, and I think more should have been done about it. For me, it's been such an ordeal. It's been a horrible, horrible experience, and I have no faith in the Metropolitan Police at all.
That was an anonymous woman speaking to The Guardian. Don, it doesn't really inspire confidence in going forward and talking about being assaulted if you get a response like that anonymous woman got there.
No, it doesn't. But I don't know enough about the details to really feel able to comment on that. What I do know from information that I get as an MP, that the work that the anti-terrorist team does, particularly in the Met but elsewhere, has led to uncovering a very large number of plots that could have caused death and serious injury to many people. And the problem is, I know, and I'm sure any MP would confirm this, that we get hundreds of people come to us with all sorts of stories, and frankly, there are some that it is just impossible to just be able to take every single one at face value, accept that it's correct and so on. So inevitably some mistakes will be made. This is obviously a very tragic one, appalling for the woman involved, and I'm sure it was a mistake that it wasn't taken seriously. But I think we have to understand the huge pressure that our police force are under.
Okay, that's it for now. We're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest you just heard there, founder of Avon Liberal Party many years ago, and also Lib Dem MP for Bath, Don Foster. After the news, phone hacking, and also more about the NHS after the news.
And is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
From the Sky News Centre at 6.